As your father, you are the only young left in the line. You are the heir apparent, whether you choose to believe it or not. What's more, your grandmother adores you, and everyone knows your grandmother controls both the Shang and Young fortunes. Nick shook his head, partly in disbelief at Colin's presumption, but more because speaking of such things, even with his best friend, made him rather uneasy. It was something that had been conditioned into him since an early age. He could still remember the time when he was 7, coming home from school and asking his grandmother at tea time. "My classmate, Bernard Tai, says that his father is very, very rich and that we're very, very rich too. Is that true?" His Aunt Victoria, immersed in her London Times, suddenly put her paper down and launched into him. "Nicky, boys with proper manners do not ever ask questions like that. You do not ever ask people if they are rich or discuss matters concerning money. We are not rich. We are simply well off. Now, apologize to your Amma." Colin continued. "Why do you think my grandfather, who treats everyone so dismissively, treats you like a visiting prince every time he sees you?"
"And here I thought your grandfather just liked me."
"My grandfather is an asshole. He only cares about power and prestige and expanding the fucking Ku Empire. That's why he encouraged this whole thing with Araminta to begin with, and that's why he's always dictated whom I could be friends with. Even when we were kids, I remember him saying, 'You'd be nice to that Nicholas. Remember, we are nothing compared to the Youngs.'"
"Your grandfather's going senile, I think. Anyway, all this inheritance nonsense is really beside the point, because as you'll soon see, Rachel is not the sort of girl who cares about any of that. She may be an economist, but she's the least materialistic person I know."
"Well, then, I wish you the best. But you do realize that even in the here and now, dark forces are at work plotting against you."
"What is this, Harry Potter?"
Nick sniggered.
"That's what you just sounded like."
"Yes, I am aware that even now, dark forces are trying to sabotage me, as you put it. Astrid's already warned me, my mother inexplicably decided to go to China right when I arrived, and I had to enlist my great aunt to persuade my grandmother into inviting Rachel tonight. But you know what? I don't really give a damn."
"I don't think it's your mother you have to worry about."
"Then whom should I be worried about exactly? Tell me, who is bored enough to waste their time trying to ruin my relationship and why?"
"Practically every girl of marriageable age on the island and their mothers," Nick laughed.
"Wait a minute. Why me? Aren't you Asia's most eligible bachelor?"
"I'm a lame duck. Everyone knows that nothing in the world is going to stop Araminta from walking down that aisle next week. I hereby pass the crown onto you."
Colin chuckled, folding his paper napkin into a pyramid and placing it on Nick's head.
"Now, you are a mocked man."
Chapter 18. Rachel and Paiklin, Singapore. After they had finished lunch, Nina insisted on giving Rachel a complete tour of Villa Doro's other wing, which, not surprisingly, was done up in the Baroque on crack style Rachel had gotten a whiff of earlier. Nina also proudly showed off her rose garden and the can of a sculpture they had recently installed there, thankfully spared the gold treatment. With the tour finally over, Paiklin suggested that they head back to the hotel to relax over afternoon tea, since Rachel was still feeling a bit jet-lagged.
"Your hotel serves a terrific high tea with fabulous Nyonya Kueh."
"What's that?" Rachel asked.
"Nyonya Kueh are these sweet, colorful dessert cakes that are a hallmark of Peranakan cuisine. You're going to love them."
"But I'm still full from lunch," Rachel protested.
"Well, you just have to get used to the Singaporean eating schedule. We eat 5 times a day here: breakfast, lunch, tea, dinner, and late-night supper."
"God, I'm going to put on so much weight while I'm here."
"No, you won't. That's the one good thing about this heat. You'll sweat it all out."
"You might be right about that. I don't know how you guys deal with this weather," Rachel said. "I'll have tea, but let's find the coldest spot inside." They made themselves comfortable in the terrace cafe, which had a view of the pool but was blessedly air-conditioned. Smartly uniformed waiters walked by with trays bearing a selection of tea cakes, pastries, and Nyonya delicacies. You need to try this quay, Baekhyun said, putting a slice of glutinous rice and coconut custard wrapped in pandan leaf on Rachel's plate. Rachel took a bite, finding the juxtaposition of subtly sweet custard with almost savory sticky rice to be surprisingly addictive. She looked around at the bucolic garden, most of the deck chairs now occupied by guests asleep in the late afternoon sun. I still can't believe Colin's family owns this hotel, Rachel said, taking another bite of the quay. Believe it, Rachel. And they own a lot more besides. Hotels all over the world. Commercial properties, banks, mining companies. The list goes on and on. Colin seems so modest. I mean, we went to one of those outdoor food markets for dinner. There's nothing unusual about that. Everyone here loves the hawker centers. Remember, this is Asia, and first impressions can be deceiving. You know how most Asians hoard their money. The rich are even more extreme. Many of the wealthiest people here make an effort not to stand out, and most of the time, you would never know you were standing next to a billionaire. Don't take this the wrong way, but your family seems to enjoy their wealth. My grandfather came over from China and started out as a bricklayer. He is a self-made man, and he's instilled the same work-hard-play-hard ethic in all of us. But come on, we're not in the same league as the Koos. The Koos are crazy rich. They are always at the top of the Forbes Asia Rich List. And you know, that's just the tip of the iceberg with these families. Forbes only reports on the assets they can verify, and these rich Asians are so secretive about their holdings. The richest families are always richer by billions than what Forbes estimates. A piercing electronic melody began to play. What's that sound? Rachel asked, before realizing it was her new Singapore cell phone. It was Nick calling. Hey, you, she answered with a smile. Hey, yourself. Having a nice afternoon catching up with your friend? Absolutely. We're back at the hotel enjoying high tea. What are you up to? I'm standing here staring at Colin in his underwear. What did you say? Nick laughed. I'm over at Colin's. The taxes just came in and we're having the tailor make some final adjustments. Oh, how does yours look? Is it powder blue with ruffles? You wish. No, it's all rhinestones with gold piping. Hey, I completely forgot to tell you, but my grandmother always has the family over for dinner on Friday night. I know you're still jet-lagged, but do you think you might be up for going? Oh, wow. Dinner at your grandmother's? Picklin cocked her head at Rachel. Who all is going to be there? Rachel asked. Probably just a handful of relatives. Most of my family are still out of the country, but Astrid will be there. Rachel was a little unsure. What do you think? Would you like me to come, or would you rather spend some time alone with your family first? Of course not. I'd love you to come, but only if you're up for it. I know, it's pretty short notice. Rachel looked at Baekhyun, deliberating. Was she ready to meet the family? Say yes, Baekhyun prompted eagerly. I'd love to go. What time do we have to be there? 7:30-ish is fine. Here's the thing. I'm at Colin's place in Sentosa Cove. The Friday evening traffic is going to be horrible going back into town, so it's much easier for me to meet you there. Would you mind taking a taxi to my grandmother's? I'll give you the address, and I'll be at the door waiting for you when you arrive. Take a taxi? Picklin shook her head, mouthing, I'll take you. Okay, just tell me where it is, Rachel said. Tyersall Park. Tyersall Park. She wrote it down on a piece of paper from her purse. That's it? What's the number? There's no number. Look out for two white pillars and just tell the driver it's off Tyersall Avenue, right behind the Botanic Gardens. Call me if you have any problems finding it. Okay, see you in about an hour. As soon as Rachel hung up, Baekhyun snatched the piece of paper from her. Let's see where Grandma lives. She scrutinized the address. No number? So Tyersall Park must be an apartment complex. I thought I knew every condo on the island. I'd never even heard of Tyersall Avenue. I think it's probably somewhere on the west coast. Nick said it was right by the Botanic Gardens. Really? That's very close. Anyway, my driver can figure it out. We have much more important things to deal with, like what you're going to wear. Oh, God, I have no idea. Well, you want to be casual, but you also want to make a good impression, don't you? Will Colin and Araminta be there tonight? I don't think so. We said it was just his family. God,
I wish I knew more about Nick's family. You Singaporeans crack me up. All this nosing around. You have to understand, this is one big village. Everyone is always in everybody's business. Plus, you have to admit, it's become much more intriguing now that we know that he's Colin's best friend. Anyway, you need to look fabulous tonight. I don't know. I don't want to make the wrong impression, like I'm high maintenance or something. Rachel, trust me, no one would ever accuse you of being high maintenance. I recognize the blouse you're wearing. You bought that in college, didn't you? Show me what else you brought. It's your first time meeting the family, so we need to be really strategic about this. Piglin, you're beginning to stress me out. I'm sure his family will be just fine, and they won't care what I'm wearing as long as I don't show up naked. After multiple costume changes supervised by Piglin, Rachel decided to wear what she had been planning to wear in the first place, a long, sleeveless, chocolate-colored linen dress with buttons down the front, a simple cinched belt made out of the same fabric, and a pair of low-heeled sandals. She put on a fun silver bracelet that wrapped around her wrist several times and wore the only expensive piece of jewelry she owned, Mikimoto pearl studs that her mother had given her when she got her doctorate.
You look a bit like Katharine Hepburn on Safari, Piglin said. Elegant, proper, but not trying too hard.
Hair up or down? Rachel asked.
Just leave it down. It's a little sexier,
Piglin replied.
Come on, let's go or you'll be late.
The girls soon found themselves winding along the leafy back roads behind the Botanic Gardens, searching for Tyersall Avenue. The driver said he had driven past the street before, but now could not seem to find it.
It's strange that the street doesn't show up on the GPS, Piglin said. This is a very confusing area because it's one of the few neighborhoods with these narrow lanes.
The neighborhood took Rachel completely by surprise, as it was the first time she had seen such large old houses on sprawling lawns. Most of these street names sound so British. Napier Road, Clooney Road, Gallup Road, Rachel commented.
Well, this is where all the colonial British officials lived. It isn't really a residential area. Most of these houses are government-owned and many are embassies, like that gray behemoth with the columns over there. That's the Russian embassy. You know, Nick's grandma must live in a government housing complex. That's why I've never heard of it.
The driver suddenly slowed down and veered left at a fork in the road, heading down an even narrower lane.
Look, this is Tyersall Avenue, so the building must be off this road, Piglin said.
Huge trees with ancient serpentine trunks rose up on both sides of the road, layered with the dense undergrowth of ferns belonging to the primeval rainforest that once covered the island. The road began to dip and curve to the right, and they suddenly noticed two white hexagonal pillars framing a low iron gate that had been painted pale gray. Tucked into the side of the road, almost hidden by the wild foliage, was a rusty sign that read, Tyersall Park.
I have never been down the street in my life. It's so strange to have apartments here, was all Piglin could say. What do we do now? Do you want to call Nick?
Before Rachel could answer, an Indian guard with a fierce-looking beard, wearing a crisp olive-green uniform and a bulky turban, appeared at the gates. Piglin's driver slowly inched forward, lowering his window as the man approached. The guard peered into the car and said in perfect Queen's English,
Miss Rachel Chu?
Yes, that's me, Rachel answered, waving from the back seat.
Welcome, Miss Chu, the guard said with a smile.
Keep following the road and stay to your right, he instructed the driver before he proceeded to open the gates and wave them along.
A la marque, do you know who that man was?
Piglin's Malay driver said, turning around with a slightly odd expression.
Who? Piglin asked. That was a Gurkha. They are the deadliest soldiers in the world. I used to see them all the time in Brunei. The Sultan of Brunei only uses Gurkhas as his private protection force. What is a Gurkha doing here?
The car continued on the road and wound up a slight hill, both sides of the driveway a dense wall of clipped hedges. As it turned up a gentle curve, they came upon another gate. This time it was a reinforced steel gate, with a modern guardhouse attached.
Rachel could see two other Gurkha guards staring out the window as the imposing gates silently rolled to the side, revealing yet another long driveway, this one paved in gravel. As the car rolled along, its tires crunching against the loose gray pebbles, the thick greenery gave way to a handsome avenue of tall palms that bisected rolling parklands. There were perhaps 30 palm trees perfectly lined up along both sides of the driveway, and someone had carefully placed tall rectangular lanterns lit with candles under each palm, like glowing sentinels leading the way. As the car headed up the driveway, Rachel looked out in wonder at the flickering lanterns and the vast manicured grounds around her. "What park is this?" she asked Piglin. "I have no idea." "Is this all one housing development? It looks like we're entering a Club Med resort."
"I'm not sure. I've never seen a place like this in all of Singapore. It doesn't even feel like we're in Singapore anymore," Piglin said in amazement.
The whole landscape reminded her of the stately country estates she had visited in England, like Chatsworth or Blenheim Palace. As the car rounded one last curve, Rachel suddenly let out a gasp, grabbing Piglin's arm. In the distance, a great house had come into view, ablaze with lights. As they got closer, the enormity of the place truly became evident. It wasn't a house. It was more like a palace. The front driveway was lined with cars, almost all of which were large and European. Mercedes, Jaguars, Citroëns, Rolls-Royces, many with diplomatic medallions and flags. A cluster of chauffeurs loitered in a circle behind the cars, smoking. Waiting by the massive front doors in a white linen shirt and tan slacks, hair perfectly tousled and hands pensively shoved into his pockets, stood Nick.
"I feel like I'm dreaming. This can't be real," Piglin said.
"Oh, Piglin, who are these people?" Rachel asked nervously. For the first time in her life, Piglin was at a loss for words. She stared at Rachel with a sudden intensity, and then she said, almost in a whisper,
"I have no idea who these people are, but I can tell you one thing. These people are richer than God."
Part 2. I did not tell half of what I saw, for no one would have believed me. Marco Polo, 1324. Chapter 1. Astrid, Singapore. Cassian was just being buttoned into his smart new Prussian blue sailor suit when Astrid got a call from her husband.
"I have to work late and won't make it in time for dinner at Amar's."
"Really? Michael, you've worked late every single night this week," Astrid said, trying to maintain a neutral tone.
"The whole team is staying late."
"On a Friday night?" She didn't mean to give away any indications of doubt, but the words came out before she could stop herself. Now that her eyes were wide open, the signs were all there. He had canceled on almost every family occasion over the past few months.
"Yes, I've told you before, this is how it is at a startup," Michael added warily.
Astrid wanted to call his bluff.
"Well, why don't you join us whenever you get off work? It's probably going to be a late night. Amar's Tanhua flowers are going to bloom tonight, and she's invited some people over."
"Even more reason for me not to be there. I'm going to be much too worn out."
"Come on, it's going to be a special occasion. You know, it's awfully good luck to witness the flowers bloom, and it will be so much fun," Astrid said, struggling to keep the tone light.
"I was there the last time they bloomed 3 years ago, and I just don't think I can deal with a big crowd tonight."
"Oh, I don't think it's going to be that big a crowd."
"You always say that, and then we get there and it turns out to be a sit-down dinner for 50 and some bloody MP is there, or there's some other sideshow distraction," Michael complained.
"That's not true."
"Come on, La, you know it's true. Last time we had to sit through a whole piano recital by that Ling Ling guy."
"Michael, it's Lang Lang, and you're probably the only person in the world who doesn't appreciate a private concert, but one of the world's top pianists."
"Well, it was Dan Leche. So tedious, especially on a Friday night when I'm exhausted from the long week."
Astrid decided that it wasn't worth pushing him any further. He obviously had 1,000 ready excuses not to be at dinner. What was he really up to? Was the texting slut from Hong Kong suddenly in town?
Was he going to hook up with her?
Okay, I'll tell the cook to make you something when you get home. What do you feel like eating? She offered cheerily.
No, don't bother. I'm sure we'll be ordering food here.
A likely story. Astrid hung up the phone reluctantly.
Where was he going to order the food? From room service at some cheap hotel in Geylang?
There was no way he could meet this girl at a decent hotel. Someone was bound to recognize him. She remembered a time not long ago when Michael would be so sweetly apologetic for missing any family occasion. He would say soothing things like,
"Honey, I'm so sorry I can't make it. Are you sure you'll be okay going on your own?"
But that gentler side of him had dissipated. When exactly did that happen? And why had it taken her so long to notice the signals? Ever since that day at Stephen Chia Jules, Astrid had experienced a catharsis of sorts. In some perverse way, she was relieved to have proof of her husband's unfaithfulness. It was the uncertainty of it all, the cloak-and-dagger suspicions that had been killing her. Now she could, as a psychologist might say, learn to accept and learn to adapt. She could concentrate on the bigger picture. Sooner or later, the fling would be over and life would go on, as it did for the millions of wives who quietly endured their husbands' infidelities since time immemorial. There would be no need for fights, no hysterical confrontations. That would be much too cliché, even though every silly thing her husband had done could have come straight out of one of those "Is my husband cheating on me?" quizzes from some cheesy woman's magazine. "Has your husband been going on more business trips lately?" Check. "Are you making love less frequently?" Check. "Has your husband incurred mysterious expenses with no explanation?" Double check. She could add a new line to the quiz. "Is your husband getting text messages late at night from some girl proclaiming to miss his fat cock?" Check. Astrid's head was beginning to spin again. She could feel her blood pressure rise. She needed to sit down for a minute and take a few deep breaths. Why had she missed yoga all week when she so badly needed to release the tension that had been building up? Stop. She needed to put all this out of her mind and just be in the moment. Right now, in this moment, she needed to get ready for Amma's party. Astrid noticed her reflection in the glass coffee table and decided to change her outfit. She was wearing an old favorite, a gauzy black tunic dress by Anne de Mühlemeister, but she felt like she needed to turn up the volume tonight. She was not going to let Michael's absence ruin her night. She was not going to spend one more second thinking about where he could possibly be going, what he might or might not be doing. She was determined that this would be a magical night of wild blooming flowers under the stars, and that only good things would happen. Good things always happened at Amma's. She went into the spare bedroom, which had basically become an extra closet for her overflow of clothes, and this didn't even include the rooms upon rooms of clothes she still kept at her parents' house. The space was filled with metal rolling racks on which garment bags of outfits had been meticulously organized by season and color, and Astrid had to move one of the racks into the hallway in order to fit comfortably into the room. This apartment was much too tiny for the family of three, four if you counted the nanny, Evangeline, who slept in Cassian's room. But she had made the best of it for the sake of her husband. Most of Astrid's friends would have been utterly horrified to discover the conditions in which she lived. To the majority of Singaporeans, a spacious 2,000-square-foot, three-bedroom condo with 2.5 baths and a private balcony in District 9 would be a cherished luxury. But for Astrid, who had grown up in such palatial surroundings as her father's stately house on Nassim Road, the modernist weekend beach bungalow in Tanamira, the vast family plantation in Kuantan, and her grandmother's Tyersal Park estate, it was totally unfathomable. As a wedding gift, her father had planned to commission an up-and-coming Brazilian architect to build the newlyweds a house in Bukit Timah on land that had already been deeded to Astrid, but Michael would have none of that. He was a proud man and insisted on living in a place that he could afford to purchase. "I am capable of providing for your daughter and our future family," he had informed his stunned future father-in-law, who, instead of being impressed by the gesture, found it rather foolhardy. How was this fellow ever going to afford the kind of place his daughter was accustomed to on his salary?
Michael's meager savings would barely even get them a down payment on a private flat, and Harry found it inconceivable that his daughter might live in government-subsidized housing. Why couldn't they, at the very least, just move into one of the houses or luxury apartments that she already owned? But Michael was adamant that he and his wife begin their life on neutral territory. In the end, a compromise was struck, and Michael agreed to let both Astrid and her father match what he was able to put in as a down payment. The combined amount allowed them a 30-year fixed mortgage on this condo in an 80s-era apartment complex off Clemenceau Avenue. As Astrid sifted through the racks, it suddenly, rather comically, occurred to her that the money she had spent on the couture outfits in this room alone could have paid for a house 3 times the size of this one. She wondered what Michael might think if he knew actually how many properties she already owned. Astrid's parents bought their children houses in a way that other parents might buy theirs candy bars. Over the years, they had purchased so many houses for her that by the time she became Mrs. Michael Teo, she was already in possession of a staggering real estate portfolio. There was the bungalow off Dunyan Road, the house in Clementi, and the semi-detached on Chancery Lane, a row of historic Peranakan shop houses on Emerald Hill left to her by a great aunt on the Leong side, and numerous other luxury condominiums scattered throughout the island. And that was just in Singapore. There were landholdings in Malaysia, a flat in London that Charlie Wu had secretly bought for her, a house in Sydney's exclusive Point Piper, and another in Diamond Head, Honolulu. And recently, her mother had mentioned picking up a penthouse in some new tower in Shanghai under her name. "I saw the special computer mirror in the closet that remembers everything you wear and immediately knew this place was for you," Felicity had excitedly informed her. Quite frankly, Astrid didn't even bother trying to remember all of it. There were too many properties to keep track of. It was all quite meaningless anyway, since aside from the shop houses on Emerald Hill and the London flat, none of the properties were truly hers, yet. This was all part of her parents' wealth succession strategy, and Astrid knew that as long as her parents were alive, she had no real control over the properties, though she benefited from the income derived from them. Twice a year, when the family sat down with their business managers at Leong Holdings, she would notice that her personal accounts always increased in value, sometimes to an absurd degree, no matter how many couture dresses she had splurged on the previous season. So what should she wear? Maybe it was time to bring out one of her latest Paris treats. She was going to wear her new embroidered Alexis Mabil white peasant blouse with the Progré Lanvin cigarette pants and her new VBH earrings. The thing about those earrings was that they looked so over the top, everyone would think they were costume jewelry. They actually dressed down the whole outfit. Yes, she deserved to look this good. And now maybe she should also change Cassian's outfit to complement hers. "Evangeline, Evangeline," she called out. "I want to change Cassian's clothes. Let's put him in that dove gray jumper from Marie Chantal." Chapter 2. Rachel and Nick. Tyersall Park. As Paiklin's car approached the porte cochere of Tyersall Park, Nick bounded down the front steps toward them. "I was worried you'd gotten lost," he said, opening the car door. "We did get a bit lost, actually," Rachel replied, getting out of the car and staring up at the majestic facade before her. Her stomach felt like it had been twisted in a vise, and she smoothed out the creases on her dress nervously. "Am I really late?" "No, it's okay. I'm sorry. Were my directions confusing?" Nick asked, peering into the car and smiling at Paiklin. "Paiklin, thanks so much for giving Rachel a lift."
"Of course," Paiklin murmured, still rather stunned by her surroundings. She longed to get out of the car and explore this colossal estate, but something told her to remain in her seat. She paused for a moment, thinking Nick might invite her in for a drink, but no invitation seemed to be forthcoming. Finally, she said as nonchalantly as possible, "This is quite a place. Is it your grandmother's?" "Yes," Nick replied. "Has she lived here a long time?"
Paiklin couldn't resist trying to find out more as she craned her neck, trying to get a better look.
"Since she was a young girl," Nick said.
Nick's answer surprised Paiklin as she assumed that the house would have belonged to his grandfather. Now what she really wanted to ask was,
Who on earth is your grandmother? But she didn't want to risk seeming too nosy.
Well, you two have a great time, Piglin said, winking at Rachel and mouthing the words, call me later.
Rachel gave her friend a quick smile. Good night and get home safe, Nick said, patting the roof of the car. As Paiklin's car drove off, Nick turned to Rachel, looking a little sheepish.
I hope it's okay, but it's not just the family. My grandmother decided to have a small party, all arranged at the last minute, apparently, because her tanhua flowers are going to bloom tonight.
She's throwing a party because her flowers are in bloom? Rachel asked, not quite following.
Well, these are very rare flowers that bloom extremely infrequently, sometimes once every decade, sometimes even longer than that. They only bloom at night and the whole thing only lasts for a few hours. It's quite something to witness.
Sounds cool, but now I'm feeling really underdressed for the occasion, Rachel said pensively, eyeing the fleet of limousines that lined the driveway.
Not at all. You look absolutely perfect, Nick told her.
He could sense her trepidation and try to reassure her, placing his hand on the small of her back and guiding her toward the front doors. Rachel felt the warm, radiating energy from his muscled arm and instantly felt better. Her knight in shining armor was at her side and everything would be just fine. As they entered the house, the first thing that caught Rachel's eye was the dazzling mosaic tiles in the grand foyer. She stood transfixed for a few moments by the intricate black, blue, and coral pattern before realizing that they were not alone. A tall, spindly Indian man stood silently in the middle of the foyer, next to a circular stone table clustered with pots of enormous white and purple Phalaenopsis orchids. The man bowed ceremoniously to Rachel and presented her with a hammered silver bowl filled with water and pale pink rose petals.
For your refreshment, miss, he said.
Do I drink this? Rachel whispered to Nick.
No, it's for washing your hands, Nick instructed.
Rachel dipped her fingers into the cool-scented water before wiping them on the soft terry cloth that was proffered, feeling awed and a little silly by the ritual.
Everyone's upstairs in the living room,
Nick said, leading her toward the carved stone staircase. Rachel saw something out of the corner of her eye and let out a quick gasp. By the side of the staircase lurked a huge tiger.
It stopped Rachel, Nick laughed.
The tiger stood as if about to pounce, mouth open in a ferocious growl.
I'm sorry, it looks so real, Rachel said, recovering herself.
It was real. It's a native Singaporean tiger. They used to roam this area until the late 19th century, but they were hunted into extinction. My great-grandfather shot this one when it ran into the house and hid under the billiard table, or so the story goes.
Poor guy, Rachel said, reaching out to stroke the tiger's head gingerly. Its fur felt surprisingly brittle, as if a patch might fall off at any minute.
It used to scare the hell out of me when I was little. I never dared go near the foyer at night, and I had dreams that it would come alive and attack me while I was sleeping, Nick said.
You grew up here? Rachel asked in surprise.
Yes, until I was about 7.
You never told me you lived in a palace.
This isn't a palace, it's just a big house.
Nick, where I come from, this is a palace, Rachel said, gazing up at the cast iron and glass cupola soaring above them. As they climbed the stairs, the murmur of party chatter and piano keys wafted down toward them. When they reached the landing to the second floor, Rachel almost had to rub her eyes in disbelief.
Sweet Jesus.
She felt momentarily giddy as if she had been transported back in time to another era, to the grand lounge of a 20s ocean liner en route from Venice to Istanbul, perhaps. The living room, as Nick so modestly called it, was a gallery that ran along the entire northern end of the house, with Art Deco divans, wicker club chairs, and ottomans casually grouped into intimate seating areas. A row of tall plantation doors opened onto the wraparound veranda, inviting the view of verdant parklands and the scent of night-blooming jasmine into the room, while at the far end, a young man in a tuxedo played on the Busendorfer grand piano. As Nick led her into the space, Rachel found herself reflexively trying to ignore her surroundings, even though all she wanted to do was study every exquisite detail. The exotic potted palms and massive Qinlong dragon jardiniers that anchored the space, the scarlet-shaded opaline glass lamps that cast an amber glow over the lacquer teak surfaces, the silver and lapis lazuli filigreed walls that shimmered as she moved about the room. Every single object seemed imbued with a patina of timeless elegance, as if it had been there for more than 100 years, and Rachel didn't dare to touch anything. The glamorous guests, however, appeared completely at ease lounging on the shuntung silk ottomans or mingling on the veranda, while a retinue of white-gloved servants in deep olive batik uniforms circulated with trays of cocktails. "Here comes Astrid's mother," Nick muttered. Before Rachel had a moment to collect herself, a stately-looking lady approached them, wagging a finger at Nick.
"Nicky, you naughty boy.
Why didn't you tell us you were back? We thought you weren't coming till next week, and you just missed Uncle Harry's birthday dinner at Command House." The woman looked like a middle-aged Chinese matron, but she spoke in the sort of clipped English accent straight out of a Merchant Ivory film. Rachel couldn't help but notice how her tightly permed black hair fittingly resembled the Queen of England's.
"So sorry, I thought you and Uncle Harry would be in London at this time of the year."
"Gai Gu Che, this is my girlfriend Rachel Chu. Rachel, this is my auntie, Felicity Leung."
Felicity nodded at Rachel, boldly scanning her up and down.
"So nice to meet you," Rachel said, trying not to be unnerved by her hawk-like gaze.
"Yes, of course," Felicity said, turning quickly to Nick and asking, almost sternly, "Do you know when your daddy gets in?"
"Not a clue," he replied.
"Is Astrid here yet?" "Aya, you know that girl is always late."
At that moment, his aunt noticed an elderly Indian woman in a gold and peacock blue sari being helped up the stairs.
"Dear Mrs. Singh, when did you get back from Udaipur?" she screeched, pouncing on the woman as Nick guided Rachel out of the way.
"Who is that lady?" Rachel asked.
"That's Mrs. Singh, a family friend who used to live down the street. She's the daughter of a Maharaja and one of the most fascinating people I know. She was great friends with Nehru. I'll introduce you later when my aunt isn't breathing down our necks."
"Her sari is absolutely stunning," Rachel remarked, gazing at the elaborate gold stitching.
"Yes, isn't it? I hear she flies all her saris back to New Delhi to be specially cleaned," Nick said as he tried to escort Rachel toward the bar, unwittingly steering straight into the path of a very posh-looking middle-aged couple. The man had a pompadour of brill-creamed black hair and thick, oversized tortoise-shell glasses, while his wife wore a classic gold-button red-and-white Chanel suit.
"Uncle Dickie, Auntie Nancy, meet my girlfriend Rachel Chu," Nick said.
"Rachel, this is my uncle and his wife, from the Tian side of the family," he explained.
"Ah, Rachel, I've met your grandfather in Taipei. Chu Yong Cheng, isn't it?"
Uncle Dickie asked.
Actually, no, my family isn't from Taipei," Rachel stammered.
"Oh, where are they from then?"
"Guangdong originally, and nowadays California."
Uncle Dickie looked a bit taken aback, while his well-coiffed wife grasped his arm tightly and continued.
"Oh, we know California very well. Northern California, actually."
"Yes, that's where I'm from," Rachel replied politely.
"Ah, well then, you must know the Gettys. Aunt is a great friend of mine," Nancy effused.
Are you referring to the Getty oil family? Is there any other?" Nancy asked, perplexed.
"Rachel's from Cupertino, not San Francisco, Auntie Nancy. And that's why I need to introduce her to Francis Leung over there, who I hear is going to Stanford this fall."
Nick cut in, quickly moving Rachel along. The next 30 minutes became a blur of nonstop greetings as Rachel was introduced to assorted family and friends. There were aunties and uncles and cousins aplenty. There was the distinguished though diminutive Thai ambassador. There was a man Nick introduced as the Sultan of some unpronounceable Malay state, along with his two wives in elaborately bejeweled headscarves. All this time, Rachel had noticed one woman who seemed to command the attention of the room. She was very slim and aristocratic-looking, with snow-white hair and ramrod-straight posture, dressed in a long white silk cheong sam, with deep purple piping along the collar, sleeves, and hemline. Most of the guests orbited around her, paying tribute, and when she at last came toward them, Rachel noticed for the first time Nick's resemblance to her. Nick had earlier informed Rachel that while his grandmother spoke English perfectly well, she preferred to speak in Chinese and was fluent in four dialects: Mandarin, Cantonese,
Hokkien, and Teochew. Rachel decided to greet her in Mandarin, the only dialect she spoke, but before Nick could make proper introductions, she bowed her head nervously at the stately lady and said, "It is such a pleasure to meet you. Thank you for inviting me to your beautiful home." The woman looked at her quizzically and replied slowly in Mandarin, "It is a pleasure to meet you too, but you are mistaken. This is not my house."
"Rachel, this is my great-aunt Rosemary," Nick explained hurriedly. "And you'll have to forgive me. My Mandarin is really quite rusty."
Great-aunt Rosemary added in her Vanessa Redgrave English.
"Oh, I'm so sorry," Rachel said, her cheeks flushing bright red.
She could feel all eyes in the room upon her, amused by her faux pas.
"No need to apologize," Great-Aunt Rosemary smiled graciously. "Nick has told me quite a bit about you, and I was so looking forward to meeting you."
"He has?" Rachel said, still flustered.
Nick put his arm around Rachel and said, "Here, come meet my grandmother."
They walked across the room and on the sofa closest to the veranda, flanked by a spectacled man smartly attired in a white linen suit and a strikingly beautiful lady, sat a shrunken woman. Shang Suyi had steel-gray hair held in place by an ivory headband, and she was dressed simply in a rose-colored silk blouse, tailored cream trousers, and brown loafers. She was older and frailer than Rachel had expected, and though her features were partially obscured by a thick pair of tinted bifocals, her regal countenance was unmistakable. Standing completely still behind Nick's grandmother were two ladies in immaculate matching gowns of iridescent silk. Nick addressed his grandmother in Cantonese.
"Ama, I'd like you to meet my friend Rachel Chu from America."
"So nice to meet you," Rachel blurted in English, completely forgetting her Mandarin. Nick's grandmother peered up at Rachel for a moment.
"Thank you for coming," she replied haltingly in English,
before turning swiftly to resume her conversation in Hokkien with the lady at her side. The man in the white linen suit smiled quickly at Rachel, but then he too turned away. The two ladies, swathed in silk, stared inscrutably at Rachel, and she smiled back at them tensely.
"Let's get some punch," Nick said,
steering Rachel toward a table where a uniformed waiter, wearing white cotton gloves, was serving punch out of a huge Venetian glass punch bowl.
"Oh my God, that had to be the most awkward moment of my life. Think I really annoyed your grandmother," Rachel whispered. "Nonsense. She was just in the middle of another conversation, that's all," Nick said soothingly.
"Who are those two women in matching silk dresses standing like statues behind her?" Rachel asked.
"Oh, those are her lady's maids."
"Excuse me?"
"Her lady's maids. They never leave her side."
"Like ladies in waiting? They look so elegant."
"Yes, they're from Thailand and they were trained to serve in the royal court."
"Is this a common thing in Singapore, importing royal maids from Thailand?" Rachel asked incredulously.
"I don't believe so. This service was a special lifetime gift to my grandmother."
"A gift? From whom?"
"The King of Thailand. Though it was the last one, not Bhumibol, the current king. Or was it the one before that? Anyway, he was apparently a great friend of my grandmother's. He decreed that she must only be waited on by court-trained ladies. So there has been a constant rotation ever since my grandmother was a young woman."
"Oh," Rachel said, stupefied. She took the glass of punch from Nick and noticed that the fine etching on the Venetian glassware perfectly matched the intricate fretwork pattern on the ceiling. She leaned against the back of a sofa for support, suddenly feeling overwhelmed. There was too much for her to take in. The army of white-gloved servants hovering about, the confusion of new faces, the mind-blowing opulence. Who knew that Nick's family would turn out to be these extremely grand people? And why didn't he prepare her for all this a little more? Rachel felt a gentle tap on her shoulder. She turned around to see Nick's cousin holding a sleepy toddler. "Astrid," she cried, delighted to see a friendly face at last. Astrid was adorned in the chicest outfit Rachel had ever seen, quite different from how she had remembered her in New York. So this was Astrid in her natural habitat.
"Hello, hello," Astrid said cheerily.
"Cassian, this is Auntie Rachel.
Say hi to Auntie Rachel,"
Astrid gestured. The child stared at Rachel for a moment before burying his head shyly into his mother's shoulder.
Here, let me take this big boy out of your hands. Nick grinned, lifting a squirming Cassian out of Astrid's arms and then deftly handing her a glass of punch.
Thanks, Nikki,
Astrid said as she turned to Rachel.
How are you finding Singapore so far? Having a good time?
A great time, although tonight's been a bit overwhelming. I can only imagine, Astrid said with a knowing glint in her eye.
No, I'm not sure you can, Rachel said.
A melodious peal rang through the room. Rachel turned to see an elderly woman in a white cheongsam top and black silk trousers playing a small silver xylophone by the stairs.
Ah, the dinner gong, Astrid said. Come, let's eat.
Astrid, how is it that you always seem to arrive just when the food is ready? Nick remarked.
Choco cake, little Cassian muttered.
No, Cassian, you already had your dessert, Astrid replied firmly.
The crowd began to make a beeline for the stairs, passing the woman with the xylophone. As they approached her, Nick gave the woman a big bear hug and exchanged a few words in Cantonese.
This is Ling Che, the woman who pretty much raised me from birth, he told Rachel.
Wow, 내 건너의 방 야감랑아, 파이디깃 fun,
Ling Che commented, grasping Rachel's hand gently. Nick grinned, blushing a little. Rachel didn't understand Cantonese, so she just smiled, while Astrid quickly translated.
Ling Che just teased Nick about how pretty his lady friend is. She also ordered him to marry you soon.
Rachel simply giggled and said, I love how she looks in those black silk trousers and white tunic.
That's her uniform. She's a black and white Amma, Astrid explained. She's part of a fast-disappearing group of domestic servants from China who came over as young women. They took vows of chastity and spend their entire lives caring for one family. Ling Che has been with us since the 1940s, I believe. She helped raise my mother.
She's almost like family then, Rachel remarked.
She is family, Astrid corrected.
A buffet supper had been set up in the conservatory, an elliptical-shaped room with dramatic frescoed walls of what appeared from a distance to be a dreamy, muted oriental scene. On closer inspection, Rachel noticed that while the mural did evoke classical Chinese mountainscapes, the details seemed to be pure Hieronymus Bosch, with strange, lurid flowers climbing up the walls and iridescent phoenixes and other fantastical creatures hiding in the shadows. Three enormous round tables gleamed with silver chafing dishes, and arched doorways opened onto a curved colonnaded terrace, where white wrought iron bistro tables lit with tall votives awaited the diners. Cassian continued to squirm in Nick's arms, wailing even louder,
I want choco cake!
I think what he really wants is S-L-E-E-P, his mother commented.
She tried to take her son back from Nick, but the child began to whimper.
I sense a crying fit on the way. Let's take him to the nursery, Nick offered.
Rachel, why don't you get started? We'll be back in a minute. Rachel marveled at the sheer variety of food that had been laid out. One table was filled with Thai delicacies, another with Malaysian cuisine, and the last with classic Chinese dishes. As usual, she was a bit at a loss when confronted with a huge buffet. She decided to start one cuisine at a time and began at the Chinese table with a small helping of yifu noodles and seared scallops and ginger sauce. She came upon a tray of exotic-looking golden wafers folded into little top hats.
What in the world are these? She wondered aloud.
That's kyeongpun tea, a nyonya dish. Little tarts filled with jicama, carrots, and shrimp. Try one, a voice behind her said.
Rachel looked around and saw the dapper man in the white linen suit who had been sitting next to Nick's grandmother. He bowed in a courtly manner and introduced himself.
We never met properly. I'm Oliver Tian, Nick's cousin.
Yet another Chinese relative with a British accent, but his sounded even plummier than the rest.
Nice to meet you. I'm Rachel. Yes, I know. Rachel Chu of Cupertino, Palo Alto, Chicago, and Manhattan. You see, your reputation precedes you.
Does it? Rachel asked, trying not to sound too surprised.
It certainly does, and I must say, you're much more fetching than I was led to believe.
Really? By whom?
Oh, you know, the Whispering Gallery.
Don't you know how much the tongues have been wagging since you've arrived? He said mischievously.
I had no clue, Rachel said a little uneasily, walking out onto the terrace with her plate,
looking for Nick or Astrid but not seeing them anywhere. She noticed one of Nick's aunties, the lady in the Chanel suit, looking toward her expectantly.
"That's Dickie and Nancy," Oliver said. "Don't look now. I think they're waving to you. God help us. Let's start our own table, shall we?"
Before Rachel could answer, Oliver grabbed her plate from her hand and walked it over to a table at the far end of the terrace.
"Why are you avoiding them?" Rachel asked.
"I'm not avoiding them. I'm helping you avoid them. You can thank me later."
"Why?" Rachel pressed on.
"Well, first of all, they are insufferable name-droppers, always going on and on about their latest cruise on Rupert and Wendy's yacht, or their lunch with some deposed European royal, and second, they aren't exactly on your team."
"What team? I didn't realize I was on any team."
"Well, like it or not, you are, and Dickie and Nancy are here tonight precisely to spy for the opposition."
"Spying?"
"Yes. They mean to pick you apart like a rotting carcass and serve you up as an amuse-bouche the next time they're invited to dine in the home counties."
Rachel had no idea what to make of his outlandish statement. This Oliver seemed like a character straight out of an Oscar Wilde play.
"I'm not sure I follow," she finally said.
"Don't worry. You will. Just give it another week. I'd peg you for a quick study."
Rachel assessed Oliver for a minute. He looked to be in his mid-30s with short, meticulously combed hair and small, round tortoiseshell glasses that only accentuated his longish face.
"So, how exactly are you related to Nick?" she asked. "There seem to be so many different branches of the family."
"It's really quite simple, actually. There are three branches. The Tiens, the Youngs, and the Shangs. Nick's grandfather, James Young, and my grandmother, Rosemary Tien, are brother and sister. You met her earlier tonight, if you recall. You mistook her for Nick's grandmother."
"Yes, of course. But that would mean that you and Nick are second cousins."
"Right. But here in Singapore, since extended families abound, we all just say we're cousins to avoid confusion. None of that third cousins twice removed rubbish."
"So Dickie and Nancy are your uncle and aunt?"
"Correct. Dickie is my father's older brother. But you do know that in Singapore, anyone you're introduced to who's one generation older should be called uncle or auntie, even though they might not be related at all. It's considered the polite thing."
"Well, shouldn't you be calling your relatives Uncle Dickie and Auntie Nancy then?"
"Technically, yes, but I personally feel that the honorific should be earned. Dickie and Nancy have never given a flying fuck about me, so why should I bother?"
Rachel raised her eyebrows. "Well, thanks for the crash course on the Tiens. Now, how about the third branch?"
"Ah, yes, the Shangs. I don't think I've met any of them yet." "Well, none of them are here, of course. We're not supposed to ever talk about them, but the Imperial Shangs flee to their grand country estates in England every April and stay until September to avoid the hottest months. But not to worry. I think my cousin Cassandra Shang will be back for the wedding next week, so you will get a chance to bask in her incandescence."
Rachel grinned at his florid remark. This Oliver was such a trip. "And how are they related exactly?"
"Here's where it gets interesting. Pay attention. So, my grandmother's eldest daughter, Aunt Mabel Tien, was married off to Nick's grandmother's younger brother, Alfred Shang."
"Married off? Does that mean it was an arranged marriage?"
"Yes, very much so. Plotted by my grandfather Tian Seitai and Nick's great-grandfather Shang Long Ma. Good thing they actually liked each other. But it was quite a masterstroke because it strategically bound together the Tiens, the Shangs, and the Youngs."
"What for?" Rachel asked.
"Oh, come on, Rachel. Don't play the naive with me." "For the money, of course. It joined together three family fortunes and kept everything neatly locked up."
"Who's getting locked up?
Are they finally locking you up, Ollie?"
Nick said as he approached the table with Astrid.
"They haven't been able to pin anything on me yet, Nicholas,"
Oliver retorted. He turned to Astrid and his eyes widened.
"Holy Mary, mother of Tilda Swinton, look at those earrings. Wherever did you get them?"
"Stephen Chia's. The VBH," Astrid said, knowing he would want to know who the designer was.
"Of course they are. Only Bruce could have dreamed up something like that. They must have cost at least $500,000.
I wouldn't have thought they were quite your style, but they do look fabulous on you. You still can surprise me after all these years. You know I try, Ollie, I try.
Rachel stared with renewed wonder at the earrings. Did Oliver really say $500,000?
How's Cassian doing? She asked.
It was a bit of a struggle at first, but now he'll sleep till dawn, Astrid replied.
And where is that errant husband of yours, Astrid, Mr. Bedroom Eyes? Oliver asked.
Michael's working late tonight.
What a pity. That company of his really keeps him toiling away, don't they? Seems like ages since I've seen Michael. I'm beginning to take it quite personally. Though the other day, I could have sworn I saw him walking up Wyndham Street in Hong Kong with a little boy. At first, I thought it was Michael and Cassian, but then the little boy turned around and he wasn't nearly as cute as Cassian, so I knew I had to be hallucinating.
Obviously, Astrid said as calmly as she could, feeling like she had just been punched in the gut.
Were you in Hong Kong before this, Ollie?
She asked, her brain furiously trying to ascertain whether Oliver had been in Hong Kong at the same time as Michael's last business trip.
I was there last week. I've been shuttling between Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Beijing for the past month for work.
Michael was supposedly in Shenzhen then. He could have easily taken a train to Hong Kong, Astrid thought.
Oliver is the Asian art and antiquities expert for Christie's in London, Nick explained to Rachel.
Yes, except that it's no longer very efficient for me to be based in London. The Asian art market is heating up like you wouldn't believe.
I hear that every new Chinese billionaire is trying to get their hands on a Warhol these days, Nick remarked.
Well, yes, there are certainly quite a few wannabe Saatchis around, but I'm dealing more with the ones trying to buy back the great antiquities from European and American collectors. Or as they like to say, stuff stolen by the foreign devils, Oliver said.
It wasn't truly stolen, was it? Nick asked.
Stolen, smuggled, sold off by Philistines, isn't it all the same? Whether the Chinese want to admit it or not, the true connoisseurship of Asian art was outside of China for much of the last century, so that's where a lot of the museum-quality pieces ended up, in Europe and America. The demand was there. The moneyed Chinese didn't really appreciate what they had. With the exception of a few families, no one bothered to collect Chinese art and antiquities, not with any real discernment anyway. They wanted to be modern and sophisticated, which meant emulating the Europeans. Why, even in this house, there's probably more French art deco than there are Chinese pieces. Thank God, there are some fabulous Sein Rulman pieces, but if you think about it, it's a pity that your great-grandfather went mad for Art Deco when he could have been snapping up all the imperial treasures coming out of China.
You mean the antiques that were in the Forbidden City? Rachel asked.
Absolutely. Did you know that in 1913, the imperial family of China actually tried to sell their entire collection to the banker J.P. Morgan? Oliver said.
Come on, Rachel was incredulous.
It's true. The family was so hard up, they were willing to let all of it go for $4 million. All the priceless treasures collected over a span of 5 centuries. It's quite a sensational story. Morgan received the offer by telegram, but he died a few days later. Divine intervention was the only thing that prevented the most irreplaceable treasures of China from ending up in the Big Apple.
Imagine if that had actually happened, Nick remarked, shaking his head.
Yes, indeed. It would be a loss greater than the Elgin marbles going to the British Museum. But thankfully, the tide has turned. The mainland Chinese are finally interested in buying back their own heritage, and they only want the best, Oliver said.
Which reminds me, Astrid, are you still looking for more Huanghua Li? Because I know of an important Han Dynasty puzzle table coming up for auction next week in Hong Kong.
Oliver turned to Astrid, noticing that she had a faraway look on her face.
Earth to Astrid.
Oh, sorry, I got distracted for a moment, Astrid said, suddenly flustered. You were saying something about Hong Kong?
Chapter 3 Paik Lin, Singapore. Wai Moon and Nina Goh were stretched out on teal-colored leather recliners in their screening room at Villa Doro, munching on salted watermelon seeds and watching a Korean soap opera when Paik Lin burst into the room.
"Mute the TV! Mute the TV!" she demanded.
"What's wrong? What's wrong?" Nina asked in alarm.
"You are not going to believe where I just came from."
"Where?" Wai Moon asked, a little annoyed that his daughter had interrupted during a pivotal moment of his favorite show.
"I just came